Miami's Catholic leader questions President Trump's deportation drive. Politicians become university presidents, and Republicans, ironically, question Colombian justice. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll talk with Miami's Roman Catholic Archbishop, Thomas Wenske, who's got a lot to say recently about the Trump administration's controversial pursuit of undocumented migrants and its swipes at the church. We'll also look at another controversial trend, top Republican politicos taking the helm at colleges like Florida International and Florida Atlantic universities. And we'll examine the trial of Columbia's former president. Is it politicized justice? All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. And happy Valentine's Day. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. We're a few weeks into President Trump's sweeping drive to arrest and deport undocumented migrants. It's been a polarizing effort, to say the least. And one of the Trump administration's biggest clashes has been with the Roman Catholic Church, including the Pope himself, over what many bishops fear is the demonizing treatment of all migrants, not just the minority of criminal migrants Trump said he would be the focus. Vice President J.D. Vance, himself a Catholic, has in turn excoriated the bishops for not being, quote, a good partner in common sense immigration enforcement, and he accuses them of shielding undocumented migrants. Catholic prelates like Miami Archbishop Thomas Wenske are now speaking out. In an op-ed in the Palm Beach Post, Wenske says he and his fellow bishops do not believe a, quote, enforcement-only policy will fix America's wrecked immigration system, and he warned that Trump's green light for federal immigration agents to enter churches is, quote, contrary to the common good. Joining me now in the studio is the Archbishop of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Miami, Thomas Wenske. Welcome to the program, Your Excellency, and thank you for coming in. Happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you, Tim. Glad to be here with you.
I want to start with what seems to be at the heart of the dispute between the Catholic Church and the Trump administration over immigration, and it's actually more theological than political. It has to do with what Catholic teaching calls the Ordo Amoris in Latin, the order of love, or who should be the priorities of our love. Vice President Vance is insisting that immigrants, and especially undocumented immigrants, should be way down the ladder of our Ordo Amoris in terms of whom our love and compassion should be going to. The Church, including Pope Francis, says Vance is wrong. Why?
Well, again, charity begins at home, and in that sense, Vance is probably on solid ground. But as Vance would be the first to recognize, because he's a veteran, I believe, that charity also would lead you to defend your country and to help your neighbor in that way. So there is a hierarchy of values, but that doesn't exclude, the neighbor in need. The good, as a good Samaritan, recognizes the neighbor as the one that needs help, that needs your assistance.
Right.
And so that's the order of charity, or the order of love, includes the neighbor in need.
And in your Palm Beach Post op-ed, you suggest that for richer nations like the U.S., migrants and refugees should be higher up than usual in the Ordo Amoris, right?
Well, in that op-ed, I noted that the Catholic teachings, the Catechism, has always recognized that sovereign nations have a right to control their borders. Sure. But at the same time, when people are looking for conditions worthy of human life that force them or expel them from their home countries, right, then the richer nations should be open to receive them. And the United States has been a country of immigrants, and for centuries we have welcomed immigrants, and we certainly are in a position to continue to do so.
Right. In your Palm Beach Post article, you also emphasize that you fear the president's mass deportation drive risks morphing from a law enforcement mission into what you call the societal demonization of all migrants, not just undocumented migrants who've committed crimes, whose deportations I don't think a lot of people object to, but also law-abiding undocumented migrants whose contribution to our economy is significant And not just undocumented migrants, but even migrants with lawful status. You say that has a, quote, detrimental effect on the body politic. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. The common good requires us to, basically promote what's best for everybody and what can advance the flourishing of society. The problem about demonization of anybody is that that offends the human dignity of the person being demonized, no matter who that person might be. To demonize the migrant is to end up blaming the victim as well, because the problem that we have are not the migrants. The problem is our broken immigration system.
Yeah.
And in many ways, if we look at this broken immigration system, these migrants are not so much as breaking the law as being broken by the law, because there are very few avenues for these people to regularize their status, and therefore they're being broken by the law as much as you could argue that they're breaking the law.
Yeah, even the conservative Cato Institute in Washington recently gave congressional testimony saying the reason we have so much illegal immigration in this country is because we've reduced so many avenues of legal migration. You agree with that?
Exactly. And for example, there are visas to bring in farm workers to pick tomatoes,
right,
and other things.
Known as the H-2A and H-2B. Yeah.
But their quotas are too low to meet the demands of the farmers.
And until recently, we didn't even offer those to Central Americans who needed them the most.
Exactly.
It was only for Mexicans. In his letter to U.S. Bishops this week, Pope Francis urged you, meaning the bishops, to oppose these mass deportations. He said, on the one hand, nations have a right to expel criminals and enforce their borders, as you just mentioned. But he said the, quote, rightly formed conscience has to disagree with, quote, any measure that tacitly or explicitly identifies the illegal status of some migrants with criminality. But polls show most Americans right now really don't agree with the Pope. They do identify illegal immigration with criminality. They do believe there has been a, quote, invasion of our southern border, which is why Vice President Vance feels politically safe associating the Catholic Church with the so-called open border crowd. Do you worry the church is being identified that way?
Well, it's certainly worrying when we are misrepresented as to what our positions are. As I said in that article, that the op-ed article, the church has never been in favor of open borders. We recognize the sovereignty of nations to control their borders, but at the same time, we're advocating to fix the broken immigration system.
Yeah.
And this is what the United States bishops have been involved in consistently for the last 25 or more years. I remember in 2001, I was with Bishop DiMarzio of Brooklyn, and we were in the offices of the head of the then INS.
Mm-hmm.
Was
known as the Immigration and Naturalization Service.
The director was Ziegler at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And the day before, President Fox of Mexico addressed a joint session of Congress, and we were in his office, and he said, we're going to make a fix on this immigration issue this year. And then I went very happily back to the airport, flew back to Miami, and the next day was 9/11.
9/11, I remember. And all those immigration reform attempts just imploded.
And we haven't been able to get it back on track.
Right.
Even Marco Rubio in the Gang of Eight during the Obama years was trying to work out an immigration fix. They got close to it, but again, it fell off the skids. So every time we've gotten close to a fix, it's not worked. But the only way that we're going to get ourselves out of this situation is for the Congress to change the laws or to make the laws workable.
Yeah.
And we're in an unworkable situation, and we just cannot just put the blame on the victims or on the migrants. We have to fix the system. And if we fix the system, then we can have a more humane immigration regime.
Now, Vice President Vance also accused the church of acting to protect, quote, their own bottom line, because he said U.S. bishops receive some $100 million to aid migrants, most of whom are Latino, which in turn is a demographic the church badly needs to keep its membership numbers up in this country. What is your response to that, especially since you preside over such a heavily Latino Catholic archdiocese here?
Yeah, I'm not sure where he got the $100 million
figure. Yeah, I'm not either.
But, I think he also completed a couple of programs that we've been historically involved with in cooperation with the U.S. government. Yep. Since the end of World War II, we've been working with the U.S. government in resettling refugees. And this certainly grew after the Refugee Act of 1980. And so we've, we worked along with Jewish organizations, Protestant organizations to receive refugees that were determined by the U.S. government, by the State Department, to be properly vetted and to be sent to the United States, and we helped resettle them.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't add to our bottom line. It gives us money that we spend in services. And it's a service that we contract with the U.S. government, because the U.S. government knows that in contracting with nonprofits like the church and like other religious organizations, we can do the job much more efficiently and economically mm-hmm. than the government. And I think, Elon Musk is showing them that right now.
At the same time, I should point out that the Catholic Church is hardly the only faith denomination opposing these mass deportations. Evangelicals, or at least Latino evangelicals, are speaking out against it. And this week, more than 24 Christian and Jewish groups filed a federal lawsuit challenging the permission the Trump administration has given immigration agents to make arrests in churches and synagogues and other places of worship. Notably absent from the suit, however, is the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Should it have joined the suit as well?
Well, I'm not sure what the discussions were at the level of the U.S. Catholic Conference, but basically, I think I don't think it's a realistic fear that they're going to come invading our churches,
right.
Because mm-hmm. basically, we're a private organization, and a government organization cannot invade private property without a legal warrant. And so right. I think I'm not that afraid of that.
Right.
Now, that doesn't say that, they haven't increased the anxiety and the fears of people around the nation. But when you look at it, people that have been liable to be deported have had this sort of Damocles hanging over their heads
yeah.
for years and years. President Obama, in his 8 years, deported about 4 to 6 million people. So deportations have been going on all the time.
Right.
There was a big to-do about the Colombians deported by President Bush a couple of weeks ago, and I think President Trump.
Right.
About 180 Colombians were deported in January,
right. mm-hmm.
but in December, the Biden administration deported 300 Colombians.
Right, right.
So,
that's a good reminder. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Miami's Roman Catholic Archbishop Thomas Wenske about President Trump's sweeping move against undocumented immigrants and the clash with the Catholic Church and other faith groups that has resulted. Archbishop, I want to pivot here to the immigration bill that the Florida legislature passed this week and which Governor DeSantis signed into law. Supporters are calling it a long overdue step to get states involved in immigration enforcement. Critics are calling it an overly draconian, if not cruel, anti-immigration measure. It mandates the death penalty for undocumented migrants convicted of murder or pedophilia. It creates a $300 million state immigration enforcement agency. It takes in-state college tuition benefits away from the Dreamers, those undocumented migrants who were brought here as children. How does this new Florida law, in your opinion, affect matters?
Well, it wasn't helpful, but it could have been a lot worse. And it would have been a lot worse had the state legislator not stood up to the governor, and basically he had to bend on a few issues. And so what we have now is a compromise, not great, but not as bad as it could have been. So immigration is a federal issue, and the solution has to come from the feds.
Now, along these lines, I know your own relationship with Governor DeSantis regarding immigration has been strained, to say the least, in recent years. I know the death penalty is another issue where the Catholic Church and the Republican Party have differences, but you make the point in your op-ed that the Catholic Church and the Republican Party that DeSantis and Trump lead do see eye to eye on many other issues, including opposition to abortion and so-called gender ideology. I believe Trump won the Catholic vote by double digits in the November election, and that included really robust support from Latinos. Do you and the U.S. bishops worry that the immigration issue could be making Catholics feel pulled in two different directions between church teaching and party loyalty?
Well, you know, I think every day when we wake up, we're pulled in two directions. Sure, we have to listen to our better angels.
Right.
And that's why we you know, we should start our day with prayer and end our day with prayer. But again, I think, you know, President Bush is a lot of things, but he's not stupid.
President Trump.
I mean, I don't know why I'm going back to Bush.
Well, one Republican, another Republican.
But President Trump is many things, but he's not stupid. And mm-hmm. and he's promised us the most prosperous economy ever. Mm-hmm. And in order to keep that promise, he won't be able to do it without making some accommodation on migration.
Yeah.
Because the migrants are contributing to the growth of this economy. And we'll need more workers to man those factories and those farms and those ranches and everything else. So
yeah.
Hopefully, you know, after, you know, he goes after the bad actors and they're a minority of
sure.
of the immigrants. But mm-hmm. as you mentioned, not too many people are going to oppose him for deporting bad actors. We have to pray that this doesn't end up destabilizing the countries where they're
sure.
deported to, but at the same time, nobody's opposing that.
Mm-hmm.
So when he's finished with those low-hanging fruit, so to speak, hopefully we can, again, make a deal, negotiate and make a deal that will help make America stronger by mm-hmm. Giving America a legal workforce and recognizing the sweat equity that these immigrants have contributed. And again, remember, there are Salvadorians in the Washington, D.C. area that have been on TPS for 25
right.
plus years. And so we need a solution. Mm-hmm. And the solution is not going to be deporting 10 or 12 million people. Mm-hmm. The solution will be fixing the laws. And you know, I've been talking about, you know, many times, and there's a law from the 1920s, and that was the immigration law that pretty much shut down immigration for
yeah.
a couple generations.
Mm-hmm.
But in that law, they had a provision called registry. And at that time, I think they said, if you were in the country before January 1, 1921, and you could show good moral character, then you could apply for a green card.
Yeah.
And the last time that registry date was updated, it was September, January 1, 1973,
yeah.
over 50 years ago. All you'd have to do is say January 1, 2015.
Yeah.
And if you did that and make the registry 2015, mm-hmm. that would take care of all the dreamers. It would take care of most of the undocumented
yeah.
in this country. And it wouldn't require a law that you'd have to pass before you could understand what was in it.
Right.
It would be 10 words or less. The new registry rate is.
That's a good immigration reform prompt there, I think, yeah. Finally, Archbishop, I want to hearken back to that fear of demonizing people that we discussed earlier. Although the church opposes abortion and gay marriage, for example, I know it also professes to teach love and compassion for LGBTQ persons or women who've had abortions. A big criticism of Governor DeSantis and President Trump and the whole MAGA movement, for that matter, is that they don't just oppose abortion and gay rights, they demonize LGBTQ and pro-abortion rights folks the way the church fears they're demonizing migrants now. If you and the bishops want to reduce that demonization culture when it comes to immigration, should you also be working harder to reduce it when it comes to those other issues?
Again, you know, I think Catholic social teaching could be summarized in one phrase: no human being is a problem. You know, and if we allow ourselves to indulge in such reductive thinking of considering human beings as problems, then we give ourselves permission to look for solutions. And in the 20th century, we saw what happened with the final solution of the successive Holocaust of the 20th century, the Ukrainians, the Jews, the Cambodians, etc. And so no human being can be reduced to being a problem. Whether no matter what his sexual orientation is, no matter what his country of origin is, no matter what his gender or sex is, nobody is a problem. They're a human being, and that dignity should be respected across the board.
Thomas Wensky is the Archbishop of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Miami. Your Excellency, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
Still to come, why are Florida politicians being made Florida University presidents? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Being a university president involves a lot of politics, from fundraising to mediating academic disputes, which, as the old saying goes, are so fierce because the stakes are so low. But lately in Florida, and especially South Florida, it feels like politics, Republican politics, is the job requirement for university presidents. Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez just got hired to lead Florida International University. Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton this week tapped former state representative Adam Hasner. Both are close allies of Governor Ron DeSantis, who hopes to reshape Florida higher education in a more conservative mold. And those ties to DeSantis and Tallahassee, and therefore enhanced access to state education funds, were a big factor for FIU and FAU trustees. In fact, it turns out FIU brought Nunez in at DeSantis's behest. But neither Nunez nor Hasner has university experience, and many professors and students worry their agendas will be more right-wing ideological than rigorously intellectual. We'd like to hear your thoughts about this. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is WLRN education reporter Natalie LaRoche-Pietri. Natalie, how are you?
Good. Thank you for having me, Tim.
I want to start with the decision by Florida International University here in Miami to bring Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez on as interim president, because it seems to have created the most controversy, most of all because of the way it came about, a sort of emergency move that some claim was imposed on FIU by Governor DeSantis. Can you walk us through how the lieutenant governor so suddenly ended up president, or at least interim president, of FIU?
Right. So the Board of Trustees at FIU voted 11-1 to install Lieutenant Governor Nunez as president. The Miami Herald said that this was a culmination of a secret plan to get her there, and it moved really quickly.
Yes,
it
yeah.
cut through the usual steps of a candidate search, like asking faculty for references or even seeking someone within their own university, just as you would hire someone anywhere.
Sure.
But you know, there might have even been a national search for the university president candidates, but there was really none of that here. And in fact, the board chairman told the board of the office that Governor Ron DeSantis requested the Nunez hire.
Right. Now, we should remind people that this still has to be approved by the State Board of Governors. But what did the FIU board cite as the main positives or upsides of having Nunez as president, even if it was imposed on them by the governor?
Funding. So they view her Tallahassee ties as a pro to securing money from the legislature. And also Nunez is a Panther. She did her undergrad and her graduate studies there.
Right.
And she'll be the first FIU president to have gone to this school. Mm-hmm. So being product of this school and also her being local is seen as a plus.
And not just local, but Latina.
Yes,
Cuban American.
That too.
I mean, and that's one of the hallmarks of FIU is how it has provided
Absolutely.
Higher education, a lot like Miami-Dade College. So yeah, there is some really important symbolism there. That's a good point, and I'm glad you brought it up. But this doesn't appear to have gone down well with a lot of FIU faculty and students who fear that this represents a sort of right-wing takeover of the university to further erode things like DEI or diversity, equity, and inclusion or scholarly freedom. This is what FIU Professor Tanya Lopez, president of the FIU chapter of the Florida Faculty Union, had to say about it.
The faculty has been vocal about their disagreement with the way that interim President Nunez was appointed. It was a total surprise for all of us. We see no need for this emergency appointment. Many members of our faculty are afraid, and with good reason, that this is just one more drop on a glass that is getting pretty full. And we do have to consider the context of this appointment within everything else that's been happening, all the legislation that's come down against DEI, against unions.
So Natalie, what are the biggest concerns among FIU faculty and students about the Nunez appointment, aside from the way it was done?
Yeah, they have a lot of things in mind. One of the things that I heard from students, as you mentioned and as was said in the clip, that they're worried that their education will more closely align with a conservative agenda. One of the things that I heard from one student, they were afraid that gender studies or women's courses would be cut from the curriculum, and that's something that they felt strongly about. And ironically, they also worry about, well, where funding will go. One student I spoke with, she was getting her PhD in ecology, and she works specifically with political ecology. She said she's worried that having Nunez head the school might weaken the money her lab gets. So it's interesting that what officials see as a pro, some students see as a con.
Right. And we've seen Governor DeSantis, for example, sort of push conservative university components at FIU, like the new Adam Smith Center for Economic Freedom. Do they feel more of that sort of thing is coming under Nunez?
Yeah, that seems to be the sentiment. And a lot of students also pointed to the new College of Florida and how the change in leadership there, orchestrated by DeSantis, changed the liberal arts school to a political stage fight as well.
Yeah. Now, has Nunez herself said anything regarding these concerns?
She issued a statement after the board vote saying that she's committed to FIU success.
Okay. And that, I would imagine, that's the extent of it.
Yeah, so far.
And I want to pivot then also to now to Florida Atlantic University, or FIU, up in Palm Beach County in Boca Raton, and its selection this week of former Republican State Representative Adam Hasner as president, which again must be approved by the State Board of Governors. But like Nunez, Hasner has little, if any, higher education experience. He is currently the executive vice president of a private prison company called the Geo Group, right? Again, Natalie, what appears to have driven FAU's decision in this case?
So FAU's road to find a president was bumpy, to say the least. I'll say that. It was a 2.5-year surge tainted by also political interests. The decision is kind of the same story as Nunez. There's a sentiment that because of his Tallahassee ties, he'll secure funding for the school. And in the past, he secured like $43 million to the school's current College of Engineering. And while he didn't attend FAU like Nunez did with FIU, he is still local.
Right. As we've seen at FIU, a lot of faculty and students at FAU have been voicing their own concerns about Hasner, if not outright protesting on campus. In fact, one of the protest chants was, quote, president, not politician, this is a campus, not a prison, etc. Here's what FAU student Nick Ostheimer had to say about it.
We know that an extreme right-wing candidate isn't good for the educational and research prospects of FAU students and their faculty, because they don't know how to run a university properly, and they're far more preoccupied with their partisan right-wing culture war agenda than they are with what's actually in the best interest of the university community.
So, Natalie, what were you hearing last week and this week were the biggest concerns the FAU community had about Hasner's selection as their president?
You know, I feel like I'm repeating myself, Tim, but it's because it's true. It's the conservative agenda coming to campuses that they're worried about, and the lack of experience. Like FIU students, they said the same thing, but they also worry that his executive role in Geo Group, the private prison company, would give the school a bad reputation. The protest at FAU was on the day of Hasner's candidate forum, which was like a Q&A session with different stakeholders, including students. During that student forum, one graduate student asked him how he would handle securing funding, and she was concerned that it may only come at the cost of programs not aligned with the conservative agenda. Mm-hmm. His response was that he checks partisan politics at the door.
Okay. Well, we should remind people, though, this is a gentleman who once boasted that he was the most partisan Republican representative in Tallahassee. But has Hasner himself responded to those concerns?
Well, he said that being a university president to him isn't blue or red, and he's committed to the university's success. And to address his lack of experience, he said that he's willing to learn what he doesn't yet know, and he'll have a good group of people around him to push him forward.
Okay. We have Manny on the line from here in Miami, who I believe is an FIU faculty member yourself. Hello, Manny. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What are your thoughts on this?
Hey, thanks for having me. As you just mentioned, I am faculty here at FIU, and I think a lot of the sentiments that are being shared right now is a kind of concern. You know, we have this unexpected change. We're getting an interim president that seems to be being put there for political reasons rather than the interests of the university. And we're concerned how that might affect the curriculum, academic freedom, and all sorts of other issues. And I think it's not just a problem here at FIU, right? We're seeing it across the state.
Manny, what do you teach at FIU?
I'm a psychology professor.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for your call. We really appreciate it. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN education reporter Natalie LaRoche-Pietri about Florida Republican politicians becoming Florida University presidents. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Now, Natalie, we heard earlier from some voices at FIU and FAU who oppose the selection of Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez and former State Representative Adam Hasner to lead those universities. But there are voices that support their appointments. And a lot of that support has to do with a feeling across the conservative community in this state and this country that higher education has become not just too liberal, but too intolerantly liberal, especially an intolerance of conservative scholarship and voices. We heard the FIU professor earlier say she's concerned DEI could be under threat on campus, but a lot of conservatives say well-intentioned DEI has instead morphed into liberal witch hunts on many U.S. campuses against conservatism. Is that a fair assessment of the conservative thinking that's going on here?
Yes, I would say it is. And also, the University of Florida and Florida A&M are in the process of hiring for their permanent presidents right now.
Right.
So it remains to be seen what will happen with those posts and how much more far-reaching this could turn out to be.
But in the case of FIU and FAU, the support for more conservative leadership like Nunez and Hasner has another component to it, right? Let's listen to the two students' voices in that regard. The first is FIU student Ethan Bazak.
Nunez is part of an administration, you know, with Ron DeSantis when she was lieutenant governor, that was inherently supportive of the Jewish people and of Israelis.
Another is FAU student Ellie Robb.
And we believe Adam Hasner is the right candidate to keep Jewish students safe and all students safe here at FAU.
Now, there's obviously a common denominator there in their support for Nunez and Hasner, Natalie, right? Tell us more about that.
Yeah, Jewish students I spoke with on campus were supportive of the presidential picks. At FAU, students said they feel that a rise in anti-Jewish sentiments has been going on campus, and they feel that Hasner, who is also Jewish, is the right person for the job. And in the broader context of the Israel-Hamas war and conservative politicians have more readily supported Israel, and that resonates with students. Ethan, the student at FIU you just heard from, told me that even though the majority of Jews may have been Democrats 3 or 4 years ago, they're less interested in party lines and more interested in who is defending Israel. Republicans have found allies in the Jewish community, or vice versa, the Jewish community has found allies with Republicans. Mm-hmm. I will also say that 2 years ago, DeSantis banned pro-Palestinian groups on college campuses.
Yeah.
And I also just want to note here that current FIU president Kenneth Jessel has expressed his and FIU support for Israel and the school's Jewish community.
Now, this isn't the first instance of Governor DeSantis and Florida Republicans getting politicians from their camp installed as college presidents. Until a few years ago, former Florida House Speaker John Thrasher was president of Florida State University. Another former House Speaker, Richard Corcoran, is now president of New College, the state liberal arts college in Sarasota that DeSantis especially targeted as a, quote, woke school that needed conservative reform. Critics say this so-called conservative takeover is reducing Florida's higher education reputation. Supporters say it's simply an overdue swing of the pendulum back to the center on our campuses. But Natalie, what sort of effect, if any, does this seem to be having on Florida higher education?
I think it's helpful to remember that colleges and universities reflect what goes on in the outside world, but at a smaller scale. Campuses are kind of like cities of their own, and especially in Florida with how sprawling campuses are, FAU and FIU have multiple campuses.
Oh, yeah.
So all the cutthroat political discourse unfolding nationally and statewide is, of course, going to find a place in higher education here. And I would especially say in Florida, as it tends to be a testing ground for policies that go national, like school voucher program that President Trump wants to replicate to amplify school choice.
So finally, Natalie, another controversial Republican politician turned university president drama has been that of Ben Sasse's short-lived tenure at the University of Florida, where the student newspaper uncovered really questionable financial practices on his part. Just real quickly, Natalie, Sasse recently resigned, so where do things stand with UF right now?
A new report from the state's auditor general found that university failed to show how any of those questionable expenses benefited the university, and that included $6.4 million in contracts with outside consultants. Okay. Sasse now works as a part-time professor and advisor to the university's trustees.
Natalie LaRoche-Pietri is WLRN's education reporter. Thanks as always, Natalie, and happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you, Tim.
Still to come, a former Colombian president is on trial, and U.S. Republicans are up in arms. Are they being hypocritical? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Former Colombian President Alvaro Uribe is on trial right now in Bogota for bribery and witness tampering. He's accused of trying to get former members of Colombia's paramilitary armies to change their testimony about his alleged ties to right-wing death squads during the country's half-century-long civil war. Here in the U.S., Republicans like Miami Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart are calling Uribe's trial a political witch hunt because Colombia's current president, Gustavo Petro, is a left-wing former guerrilla. Diaz-Balart's accusing Colombia of weaponizing its justice system as, quote, a tool of political reprisal. But critics hear more than a little hypocrisy, given how aggressively Republican President Donald Trump is moving here to weaponize the U.S. justice system, especially the Justice Department, as a tool of political reprisal. In fact, many legal scholars worry America is a bigger problem in this regard right now than Colombia is. So what's your take? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to weigh in on all of this is Pablo Rueda Sayas. He teaches international law at the University of Miami, and he himself is Colombian. Pablo, thanks for being with us. Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's to you, Tim.
Pablo, how did former Colombian President Alvaro Uribe end up being on trial for bribery and witness tampering in the first place? He was president from 2002 to 2010, during which time he's credited with beating back Colombia's Marxist guerrillas with a lot of aid from the U.S. But briefly tell us, Pablo, what brought about these charges against him?
That's a very important question, because we have to remember that Uribe came into this whole ordeal because he accused a senator,
right,
Iván Cepeda, of witness tampering. And afterwards, the court actually said that not only did Iván Cepeda was not guilty of witness tampering, but that Uribe might have committed that crime himself.
Right. But we should step back also, Pablo. Cepeda, the senator, had accused Uribe of having ties to these right-wing,
right,
paramilitary death squads, and a lot of these former paramilitary members were set to corroborate what Cepeda was saying in that regard, no?
Right. If we go back, we see that not only did Iván Cepeda say that, but many of those former paramilitary commanders had said the same thing. And back in the day when Uribe was president, many of them were extradited to the U.S. when they started talking about the links between,
right,
Álvaro Uribe and the paramilitary.
Right. So Uribe accuses Cepeda of coercing these paramilitary members to say what he wanted them to say. But the prosecutors, and again, this is back not under Gustavo Petro, but under his predecessors. Prosecutors find that, no, wait a minute, we're finding that Uribe is trying to coerce the paramilitary members themselves to change their story. So is that how we got here?
Right. That is part of how we got here.
Right. But what about also the so-called false positive scandal that Uribe is linked to as well?
Yes. Well, there's nothing there still in terms of prosecution. Prosecution has been for witness tampering and bribery and fraud to the judicial process. That's what has been being dealt with right now,
Okay.
for the most part.
Right, and when I
But
mentioned the
we
false positive, I mentioned this was a scandal having to do with the Colombian military, in which
Yes.
they were killing civilians and trying to pass those killings off as killings of Marxist guerrillas. And this is something also that Uribe, which he denies, has been linked to. But as I mentioned, Pablo, Colombia's current president is a former left-wing guerrilla himself, Gustavo Petro. And so that has led to complaints by Uribe and his supporters here, including Colombian expats and Republican leaders like Miami Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart, that the prosecution of Uribe is political persecution. From what you've seen, Pablo, is there any truth to that, or are the charges against Uribe legitimate and therefore merit the trial we're watching now?
No, we have to remember that President Petro himself doesn't have a very good relationship with the courts.
Yeah.
He has been fighting against the Supreme Court, and he has been arguing against them, among others, because they did not appoint the vacancies that they had in the Supreme Court. So he th there has been a very contentious relationship between President Petro and the courts, not only the Supreme Court, but also the Constitutional Court as
Right.
well.
But does that mean, though, that Petro is pulling the strings, as it were, in the Uribe prosecution?
No, there is a great deal of independence between the Supreme Court and the government in Colombia.
Which is an improvement for Colombia, you know, because I remember a decade ago there being a lot of complaints that Colombia's justice system was too politicized, no?
Well, I think there's always been that complaint, and I think you can always make that complaint against courts. But depending on whether they, rule against you or in favor of you.
Right.
The fact of the matter is that the way in which justices are appointed in the Supreme Court has nothing to do with the executive branch, contrary to what happens here in the US. They basically appoint themselves from lists that are given to them, to the justices, from the Superior Judicial Council.
Right.
So these are the people that take an exam and have the highest scores and the best CVs.
Yeah. But we should also point out, though, Pablo, one of the complaints that people like Mario Diaz-Balart have about this prosecution is that it came about under the attorney general that Gustavo Petro appointed. But again, that doesn't mean, though, that that prosecutor does not act independently of the president, just as the attorney general here in the United States acts independently of the president, right?
Right. Well, actually, that is wrong of the facts, because if we remember correctly, it was the Supreme Court that started this investigation
Okay.
when Uribe was a senator.
Right. So
Now,
we shouldn't be focusing so much of this prosecution on Gustavo Petro's attorney general then, as we might do here in the United States.
exactly.
Okay.
Most of the investigation took place when the Supreme Court was investigating Uribe when he was a senator.
Right. And one of the reasons that he's on trial right now, or can be on trial right now, is that he resigned his Senate seat, right?
That is correct.
Yeah. Now, Pablo, if Uribe is convicted, how seismic an event would that be, not just for Colombia, but for Latin America and the U.S.? Because it would essentially mean that a head of state of Colombia, whom Washington had handed about $5 billion 20 years ago to fight guerrillas, was in fact tied to these right-wing paramilitary groups whose war crimes were pretty appalling.
I think there's evidence of that, but yes, it would definitely be a first in Colombia. If you consider comparatively with respect to Peru and other countries in the region, there have been prosecutions against former presidents or sitting presidents.
Sure, like
That doesn't
Fujimori and
happen
that
in
ilk.
Colombia.
Yeah. No, I was just saying like Fujimori in Peru and that ilk. Yeah.
Exactly. Or many other Peruvian presidents and former presidents as
Right.
well.
So I'm sorry. You go ahead. I interrupted you there. I apologize.
So basically, it would be a first for Colombia, and some people fear that this would unleash some kind of political consequences. I am not so sure that that is true right now. Uribe has lost a great deal of the prestige that he had when he was president, and even as a senator. I think, time has passed. There's a new generation, both in the conservatives and in the liberals and progressive and in the center. So people have moved on. And I really think that institutionally, there isn't going to be much in terms of chaos, or at least the chaos that they think will come out of it.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with University of Miami International Law Professor Pablo Rueda Saiz about the trial of former Colombian President Alvaro Uribe and the issue of politicizing our justice systems, especially here in the U.S. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And so speaking to that U.S. issue, Pablo, I want to ask you, too, about whether Republicans like Congressman Diaz-Balart can really be a trusted voice when they warn countries like Colombia about politicizing their justice systems, given that we're watching the president they so strongly support, Donald Trump, politicize the U.S. justice system
No,
right now.
I do not think so.
Okay.
I mean, I think, and I'm going to say something that might be controversial for many here, courts are here in the US and everywhere, and always have been political institutions.
Right.
And it's a good thing that they are too, because they are supposed to exercise some control over political power. Whether they have done so historically is a different issue. But that's part of what they're supposed to be doing, solving conflicts between people. And also acting as a kind of balance of power.
But I'm not referring so much to the courts, I think, at this moment, as I am referring to examples like this week's effort by Trump to have federal prosecutors drop bribery charges against New York Mayor Eric Adams, largely for the transparently political reason that Adams has really been sucking up to Trump in the past few months for political reasons. Does that sort of thing, like what's going on in the Justice Department right now, the turmoil we're seeing, with the resignation, for example, of all the Justice Department prosecutors this week who are defying Trump in his efforts to get those charges against Adams dropped, is that sort of thing sort of showing that the U.S. really at this moment doesn't really have a right to be lecturing a country like Colombia on politicizing its justice systems?
Yes, I do think that there has been a break in the kind of institutional safeguards that allow people to believe in the justice system more generally. As you mentioned, it's not only about the courts, it's also about the Department of Justice and the credibility that the Department of Justice has with the American people.
Now,
That
I know you worry, Pablo, that the politicizing of justice is a problem not just for the U.S. and Latin America, but the world in general. When we look at this globally, what's driving this phenomenon today, Pablo, of seeing so much politics creep into what, we hope would be more nonpartisan judicial systems?
I think there are two things. I think, as I mentioned earlier, the justice system has been used as a tool or by political powers everywhere in all this. But I also think that there are two factors that have changed the way in which they are being used significantly. The first one is that the political system, political parties, etc., political institutions have been unable to represent their constituencies. And they have lumped a series of issues, political issues, political sensitive issues on the courts, maybe more than the courts can assume. That's the first kind of issue. Second kind of issue has to do with political polarization.
No.
And I think courts, for the most part, try to resolve conflicts. Were there political conflicts or social conflicts?
Pablo, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there for time, but that's a very, very good point that you make about political polarization. I appreciate that. Pablo Rueda Saiz teaches international law at the University of Miami. Pablo, many thanks.
Well, thank you, Tim.
Finally on the roundup, it's Valentine's Day and love is in the air and at the Miami-Dade County Courthouse, also known as Cielito Lindo. This morning, the country's clerk and comptroller, Juan Fernandez Barquin, married 20 couples, one at a time, on the steps of the 1928 historic building in downtown Miami. The couples signed up and got their marriage licenses in advance. Here's Barquin at one of the ceremonies last year.
One couple told me that it was kind of spontaneous and it's cheaper than going to Vegas, which I thought was a great response.
Yeah, cheaper than going to Vegas for sure. This is the last time the ceremony will take place at the courthouse, however, since it is expected to change locations later this year. The courthouse is hoping to keep the tradition going in the new space, but has no confirmed plans. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. Richard Ives answered the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a wonderful Valentine's Day and a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.